Let's get the meeting called to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can get Representative Murphy, if you want to get started on your bill, and we'll move it when we get a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The House File 629 is the Omnibus Retirement Bill number one. And number one is the less controversial bill. Most of the items that went into this bill were done by consensus, and most of the articles are practical housekeeping kind of changes to the current law. Article 1 concerns the State Board of Investment. There has been a federal law changed. It's called the Dodd-Frank law that was established to help investments become less risky. And if people were going to invest in the kind of investments that are called swaps, then if people were going to invest, then they would have to be regulated by the federal government and a federal market. Article 2 is the MSRS changes that are being made. Article 3 is the PERA administrative plans.
Chair Murphy, hang on a second. Officially call this meeting to order, and I'll move House File 629 to have it before us. Proceed.
Thank you. Article 4 is concerning the revised statutes, and Article 5 deals with police and fire relief associations, changes some obsolete laws. Article 6 has to do with municipalities with fire departments seeking to join the statewide volunteer plan. Article 7 is an individual bill for a Northfield employee and a current Wright County employee. Article 8 concerns the state auditor's office, and if you want more detail with much more expertise, Mr. Martin, the director of the LCPR, is here. And if you want really more detail, the plan directors are here, and Mr. Howard Bicker is here.
So I'll move the 489A15 or 15A amendment to have it before us, which is basically the delete all amendment that we've been discussing so far. All in favor of the 15A amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? motions approved. Anyway, I think if we start out, I know some questions have been raised to me about the Article 1, and if we could have Mr. Bicker come down and explain that. I'm sure that's the majority of the questions we'll start out with, and we can go from there, and then we can go into getting questions on the rest of the bill. Good morning, and welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. The request by the State Board of Investment to receive the authority to enter into swaps is something that we have been discussing for some time, both from a staff standpoint and the board's Investment Advisory Council. The Investment Advisory Council unanimously voted to support this. Now, swaps are basically a contractual relationship between two parties. One provides cash in this case, and the other would provide me or the State Board a return. For example, if there was a contract for the S&P 500 equities, instead of us going out and buying all the individual stock and incurring all the individual transaction costs related to them, I could negotiate or buy a swap contract, which would give me that return over a six-month period or a year period. Now, a lot of people have, over the past, heard about swaps. And swaps used to be what we would call the Wild Wild West. They were all individually negotiated between two parties. With the advent of the financial crisis of 08 and 09 and the passage of Dodd-Frank, financial swaps are now going to be standardized. They're going to be cleared through a federally regulated exchange. There will be daily mark-to-markets and market values, and we basically have eliminated counterparty risk. Now, people who have expressed a concern related to swaps were absolutely right in expressing their concerns prior to the advent of Dodd-Frank. We did not request, nor did we really want, the authority to do swaps until they became standardized and we could basically eliminate counterparty risk. It basically is a tool that we can use for various portfolio management techniques, like rebalancing our portfolio. Instead of going out and selling a bunch of things, we could sell a swap or buy a swap. We do not plan on using these extensively, but we will use these when they're appropriate. Individual managers can use them to modify the characteristics of a portfolio. We also have been asked, and rightfully so, will this make you guys look like a hedge fund? Will you be leveraging things and so on and so forth? The answer to that is no. We cannot, by law or by the Constitution, leverage our portfolio. So these are actually very conservative investment vehicles. They can be used as a cost-effective tool for us to manage our portfolio. And those who have had concerns and, you know, knew about swap markets prior to the advent of Dodd-Frank and the implementation of the rules of Dodd-Frank and the federal government establishing a control mechanism for the clearance and the daily mark-to-market were absolutely correct. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we think this is a tool that the State Board can use to more cost-effectively run our portfolios. It is not a risk-increased tool. It's probably actually a risk-decreasing tool for us. And, you know, as we continue to expand this market is brand new. It basically opened a month ago, or actually during this month. And we are just getting ready to use this market. We won't be using it for quite some time. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's a quick review of what swaps are and why we are here.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Would Warren Buffett approve investing in the swaps market, and is he doing it?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, Warren Buffett invests only in individual companies. He does not do an overall portfolio. I think, actually, Buffett would approve of these.
Did you ask him?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, you probably have more authority to get to him than I do.
Representative Pepin, do you have any questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't raise my hand.
Oh. I know you could ask me about it last night.
Getting called on a last question.
She always, Mr. Chairman, she always says something after I do. So it's always.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, that's because you're an institution here and you always have really wise things to say. And since you were elected when I think I was in wearing a diaper
not
still.
Not born.
So. Mr. Chair, Mr. Bicker, I know very little about swap contracts because this isn't my area of expertise by any means, but I have been contacted by a few other legislators as well, Representative O'Driscoll on this committee, who couldn't be here today, had concerns with this. Another legislator who is an expert in this area, as well as a few other people who are very concerned about using swaps. There's an article about Denver School District that that I just have here that talks about exotic deals putting Denver schools deeper in debt, and that was when we Googled swaps, that came up. And so I'm very concerned about this, just not knowing a lot about it. You said yourself that it's a new market and month old, and but you feel that it's a risk decrease tool, but that's not the information that I've gotten. I've heard that it's very risky. And so I'm very nervous about using this, and so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, Denver isn't the only one. There are some municipalities who have tried to do very exotic swaps to try to control the interest rate on the municipal debt, and some of them have blown up. None of those contracts have been or would be cleared on a federal exchange. These are individually negotiated contracts. Mr. Chairman and members, as I said, we didn't even want to play in those markets. We're only going to play in the government-regulated markets with standardized contracts. All of the contracts you're talking about and that people have read about are individually negotiated deals between a school district and some firm. And those have been, in some instances, a disaster. That is not allowed in this statutory request. We could not even do it if we wanted to. Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, also what I would suggest is that I've met with Representative O'Driscoll prior to the Pension Commission meeting, and he was fine at that point. Time and I, everybody has a chance to change their mind. If the committee could move this along, I will personally meet with whoever or whatever the list is of individuals who have had some concerns as related to this to try to alleviate whatever concerns they have. Because the swap market that you're talking about, and if it's those articles that is concerning the members of the House, hopefully we can assure you that we have no ability and no interest to enter into any of those kinds of swaps. We are looking at portfolio swaps, not the swaps that people are using when they're issuing municipal debt. First of all, we don't buy municipal debt, so we're not even in that market. But even if we were, we could not do the swaps that you are talking about because they are not going to be standardized swaps and would not be cleared through a federally governed exchange.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Becker. I might leave some of the tough questions about swaps and things for other people, but I'm wondering, is the reason that we're going in this direction, part of it is because the assumption for return that we have in the state, I'm not sure, I can't remember what it was, is it 8% or close to 8%? We've had discussions on that. Obviously, in the last few years, the market hasn't reflected, the overall market hasn't reflected such a high rate of return. So I'm thinking, and I have others who have far more expertise in this, saying that that percentage should be maybe more like 5 or 5.5 or something to use as an assumption. And so I'm wondering, is the reason that we're getting into this type of contract because of that high percentage that we're of expectation that we're requiring you to use?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, this would have absolutely nothing to do with our return assumptions. This is just the ability to do what we already can do, sometimes in the swap, sometimes in the cash market. So this does not change the ability, our ability to buy or sell securities. It gives us a new way, in some instances, much more cost-effective way to get some market exposure that we would normally have to go out and buy individual securities, which have higher transaction costs and swaps to. This has absolutely nothing to do with the assumed rate of return.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Becker. Do you have a copy of a swap contract? I know I'm not going to have time to look at it today, but before the next stop, maybe do you have some examples or the contract that we could take a look at?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, we do not. Some of those are still being developed, but we can provide you with what we can get. We would not, if we were granted this authority, we would probably not be even utilizing it for a year or so. We want these markets to develop and develop some liquidity. We're just getting ready and anticipating our ability to use these markets.
Representative Pepin,
it's just like, I mean, some of you are from outstate and use futures markets for corn, soybeans, and whatever. These are just like these markets. They are traded. They're, you know, you call up and you just clear a contract. I don't sit and negotiate a contract anymore when it comes to a swap. I don't negotiate a contract when it comes to futures. We use futures to buy stocks. We can use futures to, you know, modify some of our portfolio. It's just the same thing with these swaps. These are standardized vehicles that we can use to, you know, establish a stock portfolio or modify a bond portfolio. It does not allow us to increase our risk.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bicker, I think this is probably my last question for now until maybe some other people will spark some more questions in me. But just wondering, what would be the, I guess, the you know, max that you could hope to achieve with this versus what would be the downside? What's the worst that could happen if we got involved with this?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, the reality is it really doesn't change our exposure. If stock market goes down, stock market's going to go down, and we're going to lose money if we own IBM stock or if we own a swap. It really doesn't change our risk exposure. It just gives us the ability to, especially from a rebalancing standpoint, we try to maintain, you know, say 45% domestic equities. If the market runs like it has lately, which has been very nice, we'll rebalance back. We may in the future have a swap on so that instead of having to go out and sell 500 securities for $1 billion, we can just sell a swap. And I guarantee it's going to be a lot cheaper to sell a swap than it is to sell 500 securities.
Thank you.
Any further questions on this issue? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bicker. By people who are smarter than I in this area, I've been told that there is an investment policy statement that we're supposed to have with our portfolio. Does it allow for the usage of swaps?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, we have a discussion topic, you know, and we provided that some of this information to you and to get swaps. If we are granted the authority, we will write the utilization of swaps into our our operations manual. But we don't buy swaps right now. So prior to the implementation of this, there will be a operations piece written by the State Board of Investment.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Bicker, what's the it seems to me, as I listen to this and listen and learn more about this, it seems that maybe the cart is partially before the horse here. Why are we moving so quickly into this? Back to Representative Pepin's question, it seems to coincide with a problem with our pension funds and not being funded at the levels they need to be, and we've been running behind over the years here. So it seems to coincide with that, but where's the fire?
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it coincides with Dodd-Frank. It doesn't coincide with anything other than Dodd-Frank. Swaps have been around for 100 years. But the swap market that has existed in the past has been an individually negotiated market that has some inherent risk. when you establish rules and establish a federal clearing and a daily mark-to-market and daily pricing and transparency, you have a whole different world. And that is the world in which we are prepared to play if the legislature grants us the authority. We were not prepared to participate in a swap market that was not regulated and that there was all kinds of potential issues. Those issues have been cleared up by the standardization of these contracts, the mark-to-market contract, and the federal regulation. So it really has no, it does not coincide with the funded status of our plans. It does in the sense that 2008, 2009 was basically the reason Dodd-Frank was written. But what we are bringing to you now as a proposal was as the offset of a Dodd-Frank law.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Bicker, so what I gather from that, it sounds like, I mean, we have, I mean, Dodd-Frank came in, and these are now safer investments, safer tools than they were before. Is that what I understand? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is absolutely correct.
Representative Ruskowski, sorry for cutting you off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Bicker. I just wonder institutionally whether this is obviously a very new thing. I know they've been around for 100 years, but a new introduction to our portfolio as a state government, and it just seems the institution around here is quite a ways behind the understanding of these tools and where they're at. If this bill went forward without the section or the article in it on swaps that would give that authority, and then you know we'd have time to learn more about that as a group, as an institution, and came back 2 years from now and provided that authority at that point, would that somehow hamstring your ability significantly?
Mr. Bicker.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, to say we know nothing about this, for example, my advisory, the State Board of Investments Advisory Council has people from 3M and General Mills and Target and so on and so forth. These people have been using swaps forever. So we have access to a significant amount of knowledge as it relates to swaps. We are asking for this authority to get ready to do hopefully certain things. If you want to wait 2 years, fine with me, because I won't be here. I'm out of here. I'm out of here in 8 months. The reality was, another thing was, to be very candid with you, instead of the new director of the State Investment Board, whoever that may be in a year, coming to you and trying to go through a legislative process that he or she may not know a lot about, let's get this in place so that we have this tool in the board's ability suitcase to ready to go. And you know, whatever we do, whenever we've done anything, the process starts with staff, it goes through the Investment Advisory Council, we write position paper, we bring it to the board before we implement any of this authority. This is not something that we are planning on doing tomorrow. But the idea is, we know this market's going to be out there. It's out there. It's not fully running yet, but we know how it's going to run, because it's going to run the same thing as futures markets run. So all we're saying is, let's get the authority. Let's get ready for this. If the legislature doesn't want to grant the State Board of Investment the authority, that's obviously your choice. We think it's a market now that can be very helpful for us and reduce costs and allow us to manage our overall portfolio. All we can do is try to convince you of that.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bicker.
So, Mr. Bicker, you're not changing your stripes and becoming a wild and crazy guy. And I mean, I've always known that you to be fairly conservative in your investment philosophy. You're not changing your stripes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no. Actually, again, like I said, this is actually a a method that could very easily reduce our costs instead of increase our costs.
Any further questions on Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening to this conversation and the questions that my colleagues have asked, and I, too, until recently, knew nothing about swaps. So I spent quite a bit of time speaking with a number of people who work, you know, within this industry, and they fired off so many questions that, you know, it's really heightened my awareness. In fact, I'm really, you know, very nervous about this. I think this is just a huge issue. In fact, when you mentioned that this is now going to be run by a federally governed exchange, that verbiage, given what we've been challenged with regard to the health care exchange, really adds to my level of nervousness, and maybe it shouldn't. But some of the things that they said were, some of the questions and comments that they made were that, you know, these swaps sound innocuous, but I think that there's so much that, you know, people just don't know about Dodd-Frank. It is new, and that this adds to my level of concern, too. In fact, to Representative Drazkowski's point, I'm wondering if it doesn't make sense for us to really spend some time and come back with the second election or the second pensions omnibus. Take this section out right now. In fact, maybe I'd like to make an oral amendment to that fact to strike this section one, article one, from this now, and come back more prepared with, let's see, what's the terminology, the investment policy statement that would speak to this. I mean, it might give us a greater comfort level. Wondering if that would be an amendment, potentially a friendly amendment, Representative Murphy.
Representative Murphy. Mr. Bicker, I think I heard Mr. Bicker say at the beginning that he'd like to, if we get, but this is going to Ways and Means, and he'd like to have the opportunity to speak with some of the people that have expressed concerns about this, and if he can alleviate some of those concerns, that he'd be willing to let it get taken out in Ways and Means. But Representative Murphy,
Mr. Chair, we're not sure about Pension 2 yet, and those in Pension 2 are tied up more with financial, actual needing money from the legislature, state aids from the legislature, and I wouldn't want the discussions of that nature to get mixed up with investment policy statements, but it's the will of the committee. But we're going to have an omnibus pension one bill for sure, whether this article is there or not. And so I would rather ask in good faith to keep it in one and proceed and have Mr. Bicker make calls on individuals that wish him to call and go forth if we can.
Representative Murphy, what happened in the Senate? I believe they heard this yesterday. What happened to the Senate? Is it still this provision still in the Senate bill?
It's my understanding that it is.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. I'm wondering if Mr. Bicker, you said you'd be willing to meet with members, and I know you've met with Representative O'Driscoll. I think he probably still would like to have some questions. I know one legislator in particular who is, this is his line of work, who I guess I'd feel more comfortable if he, if you'd had a chance to meet with him and discuss it. So perhaps if you could, Representative Albright, if you could meet with Representative Albright, and I'd really like to talk to him before... you know, before I see this again on the floor or whatnot. So if you'd be, I guess I'd feel comfortable if you'd be willing to talk to him before Ways and Means, and then we could kind of get his feedback and whatnot. That'd make me feel more comfortable.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pippin, I'm more than willing to meet with whoever you all believe is appropriate. I'm more than willing to do so.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Pippin, I too would like to meet with them so I could hear the questions, because you're helping me too.
Well, I'm not, he will.
Well, yeah. Your questions help too, because I have good notes now.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just have one other thing to add in that, in speaking with Representative Albright, one of the points that he made and followed on Mr. Is it Bicker? With one of the comments you made about major, you know, corporations, right, being a part of this board, and you know, the expertise that they have, you know, obviously within their companies, to be playing with this or having experience, he said that frequently, and I don't want to misquote him, but frequently those members of the board have not personally experienced the interaction with this new complex tool, and so, you know, that's a concern too, you know, that that people that haven't had this technical experience, and again, just the complexity of all of this, it's just the more questions I heard, the more questions I have, the more nervous I got, so that's why I entered into this line of questioning.
Mr. Bicker.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, first of all, the people on my advisory council have actually negotiated these contracts, so they are, but these are the people on my advisory committee, are the people who run the pension plan at 3M and run the pension plan at Cargill and run the pension plan at, you know, at 3M. So these are, you know, people who do this for a living. They're not, you know, the chairman of the board or something like that. Second of all, a lot of the concerns, and again, I'm the first to admit, are rightfully, you know, you have every right to have the concern with the way the market used to run. It was the wild, wild west. And some of these things were all individually negotiated, and you had to really know what you were doing. Obviously, some of these districts in Denver or whoever got some very bad advice. We have no intention of playing in those areas, because we can't. They would not be traded on a standardized market regulated by the government. Now, I know some of you, as you said, get a little concerned when the government gets involved. The reality is the government, in many instances, when it comes to the financial markets, have been very helpful. I mean, standardization and controls of some of these are necessary. We've seen what happens when there is no control, and we've had some pretty serious financial ramifications to that. But Mr. Chairman and members, all I can say is we think this is, again, a tool that we can use to hopefully more effectively run our portfolio on a more cost-effective basis and not change the risk exposure of our portfolio. We are more than willing to sit down and discuss this with any individuals who have some questions as it relates to this.
Representative Cotton.
Well, first of all, being prompted by a very competent staff member, I did Google swaps to find out that swaps was, when you Google swaps, you find out that swaps was a triple crown winner. He was also the great-grandson of War Admiral and the great-great-grandson of Man O' War, if you want a pedigree on that. And I do have, Mr. Bicker implied that I have a better connection to Warren Buffett than he does. That's not true, but I have a good connection to some very good friends of Warren Buffett, and I will also check with them about what they think about the swaps market.
So, Representative Peckman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, maybe you could check with your father-in-law, who I believe is still going to work every day at 105?
107.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd be interested in what he had to say as well.
That was what I was going to speed dial, but you can't use your phones down here. So, let me seriously add that I believe we should keep this. If we take this out of the bill, we won't discuss it anymore, and it will be in the Senate bill. I seriously think we should leave this in the bill going forward and continue the discussion. It's the only way we'll continue the discussion is to leave it in. So please don't try and amend it out.
Mr. Picker.
And Mr. Chairman and representatives, I am not one to tell anybody what to do, but when you talk to people about swap markets, you're talking about the old swap markets. You're not talking about the new federally regulated, standardized daily mark-to-market, daily pricing, transparency market. So, you know, be careful in the sense that people will talk about issues like these school districts who did these interest rate swaps and got murdered. Those are not the swap markets that we are talking about. We're talking about swap markets to get risk exposure equal to the Standard & Poor's 500. We're talking about different types of things. So, you know, and again, I would just suggest or request that when you talk to people about swaps, make sure that they say, oh, I hate swaps. Well, yeah, you might have got killed 10 years ago in a badly negotiated swap. That is not what we are looking at. We are looking at a whole different arena.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bicker, you may have covered this, and if you have, just ignore my question, but the big upside I see here is the elimination, as your outline discusses, of transaction costs, which are often the biggest drag on pension performance and return because it costs money to do what you're doing. Can you give us any sense of the long-term benefit of eliminating or significantly reducing transaction costs in pension returns?
Or Mr. Bicker, what is the risk to the fund if we don't have this as part of our toolbox?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, for example, let's say we had $500 million we wanted to put in the stock market. If you put it in with a manager, you're probably paying them something, 10, 20 basis points. You're probably doing somewhere around 40 basis points of transaction costs going in. So you do the math, and that's, $5 million, something like that. We do a swap, we can probably do it for basically one or two basis points or 100 grand. So, you know, how many of these we'll have in place, who knows? It depends on, you know, how the market is going, where we are. But just some cost. When you pay money to somebody, you can't get that back. Or it's tough to get that back. You're always behind the eight ball. And our goal has been try to keep run this thing as reasonably as we can. And our costs in running our operation are pretty low. And we're trying to get them lower.
So, Representative Pugh, did you want to make that motion, or are you willing to? She's shaking her head no, so we'll go forward. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about another area of the bill.
I was going to try and move on to other areas of the bill. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Bicker.
Thank you,
Mr. Bicker, for being willing to meet with Representative Albright and continue the discussion on this.
And Representative Pepin, if there are other people that want to set up a meeting and meet with them and get that, you know, get the questions answered and make people comfortable with it. Like I said, it's going to be in Ways and Means. If we still have concerns, if we can take it out in Ways and Means, it can be taken out on the floor. So we've got time before it gets farther along.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, see that there's the legislator plan and the constitutional officer plans were consolidated together, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, the proposal is part of the MSRS administrative provisions. This is Article 2 of the amendment that you just adopted, was recommended by the MSRS board. What the intent is, as I understand their rationale, is to merge the two plans together for actuarial and financial reporting reasons. The two plans will not be interrelated as far as benefit coverage. They're going to retain the same benefit coverage. The constitutional officers plan now covers, I believe, 7 retirees and maybe 1 deferred member, no active members. So it's a very modest plan. It's funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. There are no assets to the plan. Running an actuarial valuation every year, having it in the annual financial reporting of MSRS has a certain cost to it. By putting it administratively with the legislator's plan, which is being phased out, there are, I believe, 27 active legislators who are still in the legislator's plan, a couple hundred retirees, simplifies. It has 1 actuarial valuation cost and limited financial accounting costs, and that's the rationale for it.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Helpful.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, is there a, I've been told there's a section, is it in Article 2 talk, the section of the bill that Representative Pepin was asking about that allows MAPE union employee staffers from MAPE union to take part in the state retirement system?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you're really looking at Article 8, I'm sorry, Article 7 of the bill. This would be primarily Section 1 of Article 7, so if you have the amendment, you look at page 147 of the amendment on the bottom of the page and then the top of 148. Minnesota law currently allows in MSRS General, the General Employees Plan, ERA General, and TRA, that employees of labor unions, of the collective bargaining representative of the members of the plan, to be in the public pension plan, employees of the union who are former members of the plan who are on leave of absence from their employer. And in the main, that was the way union employees became union employees. They were employees of state or local government, shifted to the union to not have a disruption in their pension coverage. They have been permitted to be members of the plan if they were on leave. Some unions, and MAPE is not the first, the engineers union and the middle management unions have employed individuals who are not on leave from state employment. MAPE is also has employed some individuals who are not former state employees, and to have consistent pension coverage throughout their entire employee group, they're asking to be treated like the middle management and the engineers union, and be able to put any of their employees in the public employee pension plan. If you're interested in seeing the middle management or engineers language on page 147, this would occur on lines 147.30 and 147.32. This was done in the first instance, I believe, with middle management 4 years ago and with the engineers 2 or 3 years ago.
Representative Ruskowski.
We do have a representative from MAPE here too, who also can talk to you about what their motivation or intent is.
Mr. Martin, they would be making employer and employee payments into the plan just like anybody else.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the member would be making the regular member contribution by deductions taken by MAPE and sent to the MSRS plan, and MAPE as the employer would be making the employer contributions the same contribution rate that everyone else pays.
And Mr. Martin, would there be any risk to the fund by having these extra people, handful of people, or how into the fund?
Mr. Chairman, there are two potential risks, I suppose, in theory. One is a question of federal tax qualification issues. The federal government regulates pension plans. It regulates private sector plans more extensively than it does public sector plans. And it defines governmental pension plans in the 1974 ERISA statute. And it doesn't talk about plans with a mixed membership. What the federal government has done as a consequence, if a governmental plan includes some non-governmental employees, as long as they're a de minimis number, and the de minimis is not defined by the federal government, but it's applied as a principle, but it means an insignificant number in some sense. As long as it's insignificant or de minimis, there is no problem with considering a governmental plan, what we would refer to as a governmental plan, as a governmental plan for federal tax purposes, notwithstanding this handful or small number of non-governmental employees covered by the plan. MSRS, with in excess of 48,000 active members, the handful of MAPE employees would not cause that, would not exceed that de minimis level in all probability. The other issue is financial. With respect, if the MAPE union were for some reason not to regularly transmit member deductions or pay its employer contributions, it's a little more difficult, but slightly more difficult to get those contributions out of this entity compared to a state agency where MSRS can simply call up the Minnesota Management and Budget and have the transaction made. They would have to actually threaten some legal action to get the omitted contributions if there were any. Presumably that doesn't happen with it can happen now with employees who are on leave, so it's not any greater risk, but there is this slight collections risk, but there are very limited cases of collection problems. The most significant we've had were actually with charter schools and our various teacher pension plans years ago, and after some retooling of the law, we solved that problem.
Representative Bruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Martin. It just seems, I guess a question, first of all, would be, are there any other places, any other non-governmental employees other than members of the Middle Management Association, or I should say employees of the Middle Management Association or employees of the Minnesota Government Engineers Council who are non-government employee members of MSRS at this point? Or are those the only ones that we're aware of?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you look at the on page 146 and 147, you can get some flavor of this. If you look on 146.24, employees of the State Horticultural Society. The State Horticultural Society, at best, is probably a quasi-governmental entity. I'm not sure exactly how it's constituted. The Minnesota Crop Improvement Association would be a potential instance of someone who is employed by a, at best, quasi-governmental entity. If you also look at page 147, line 8, the Minnesota Safety Council would be another example. And on 147.18, Representative Kahn might want to chime in at this point. This is the Foster Wheeler employees, the former University of Minnesota steam plant employees who were privatized and now employed by, or were at least previously employed by Foster Wheeler. Is there 6 or 8 or 10 plan employees who were continued in MSRS coverage after they were privatized? So there are some instances currently.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Collins.
Since my name was mentioned, I guess I get to comment. Since that plant is about to close, what's going to happen now?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman.
I do win these battles eventually. It may take 20 years or so.
Representative Khan, the coverage by MSRS only is going to continue if the plant were open and these employees were still employed at that plant. It's not something that they have as a matter of right as individuals. It's by virtue of the relationship as continuing employees in a particular facility, notwithstanding who the private sector employer is.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, if you add up all of these that we have so far written into law and pages reflected on pages 146 and 147 of the bill that you pointed out, any idea how many people that represents at this point?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, but Mr. Bergstrom is here, and if anyone can make an educated guess, since he administers this plan, he would be the better choice.
Thank you. Mr. Bergstrom heading down to the microphone, and welcome to the committee. Please
Thank
state
you.
Your name for the tape. And
My name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And Representative Drazkowski, I don't have the exact number, but all of those entities that were named are very, very small. Foster Wheeler's got a handful. I think even a lot of what the Minnesota Crop Association and some of these other firms are created by statute, so they may even sort of meet public definition of rules if they are created by statute. They probably would qualify on that behalf. We only have, I think middle management has 4 people, MGEC has 1, the group MAPE is talking about have fewer than 20 employees. So all told, I don't know what the exact number, but it's probably in the 100 to 200 people range. It's very minimal.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Do either you or Mr. Martin know what is that point at which we are kicked out of the de minimis box that was mentioned for federal
Mr.
consideration.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drakowski, I don't know. They don't define de minimis, and I don't think we're anywhere near that with our 48,000 people, our 30,000 retirees. I don't think we're anywhere near. The IRS has not. We've asked for we've looked for that, and they have not. But I know there are other plans that have way more than we have that are still qualified. And I would also like to add that we recently submitted our plan to the IRS for approval, and that included the engineers and middle management and all of these other folks, and they gave us a clean report, and they did approve our tax-qualified status. We just received that about a year and a half ago, and if there was a question, they would have asked it at that point. Certainly these fewer than 20 people aren't going to change that. So the IRS looks at our plan regularly, and if they have a problem, I'll come back screaming because we can't lose our tax-qualified status.
But. Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. We're growing the number of people in this area. We're going to add another 20. That's, I think, the second biggest union in state government. AFSCME would be right behind it, if I remember correctly. There's another 55 employees or something in that organization, and they'll be coming next. Mr. Chair, I would move an oral amendment to delete line 147.35 from the bill.
Representative Ruskowski moves the oral amendment. Mr. Shepard, sure you have that.
Mr. Chair, I think the amendment technically would be stated as delete Article 7, Section 1. That whole section would come out of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. And Mr. Chair, if I could get a roll call, that would be great.
And roll call has been requested. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, just one point of clarification regarding AFSCME. They have their own pension plan, so they would not be looking at coming in. But
Representative Khan.
I would strongly oppose this amendment. In general, adding what are probably healthy, well-earning people to a pension plan is kind of a good thing to do. You know, and as we're talking about 20 out of 48,000, so it's not going to have much effect anyway. It just kind of seems like a nasty attack on something that's that has been worked out by the people who know what they're doing.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, can you tell us how much money it would save the state by getting rid of this?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, to eliminate them from the plan, it wouldn't save anything.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we'll take a clerk will take the roll on the amendment to remove section Article 7. So
Nelson?
No.
Pepin?
Aye.
Dill?
No.
Dorholt?
No.
Jaskowski?
Aye.
Falk?
No.
Hansen?
No.
Kahn?
No.
Lean?
Nay.
Q?
Yes.
Sanders?
Aye.
Tice?
Yes.
Winkler?
No.
Eight no's and five yeses. The motion fails. Further discussion on the pension bill. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this is, well, I guess there's a switch. I didn't even notice Mr. Martin's back. Mr. Martin, I'm just wondering if there are changes to the volunteer firefighter pension plan in here as well.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, Article 6 has changes to both the statewide volunteer fire plan and also provisions that change things for or represent some changes in the others, the law governing the other 700 or so local volunteer fire plans. The first part of the Article 8, Section 1, is the only provision that, I'm sorry,
Article 6.
Actually, Section 3 of Article 6 has to do with the statewide plan, and this is a request from municipalities. The change is on page 136 down on lines 29 and 30. This has to do with the election of the statewide plan. Currently, there are 66, something like that, plans, fire departments that have chosen the statewide plan. That's a change that's made or an election that can be made once per year at the start of a calendar year. It is preceded by a workup of the actuarial costs of joining the statewide plan and a submission of that to a municipality, and then the municipality either approves or does not approve the shift. The municipality, especially small townships that have infrequent township board meetings, requested an increase in the amount of time that they have to consider the proposal of going into the statewide plan, and the change here is to shift that deadline date from 90 days after PERA submits the actuarial work, the financial cost work, to 120 days. The balance of this article represents the work of the volunteer fire working group that's put together by the state auditor's office every year and has done so for the past 6 or 7 years. Most of this is fairly technical and non-substantive changes, does not make any particular policy shift. Perhaps the sole item in this entire portion of the article has to do with would be found, I'm sorry, on page 142-143, section 9 of Article 6, having to do with the deferred service pensions and interest on deferred service pensions in lump sum volunteer fire plans. And the thrust of the change, the most significant part of it, would be on page 143, lines 25 through 27. Originally, when the volunteer fire laws were recodified in 1979, there was no interest on deferred service pensions. Something that occurred over time after 79 was the addition of interest that's paid on deferred service pensions. A volunteer firefighter who puts in their somewhere between 5 and 20 years of service, but discontinues volunteer fire service, would be entitled to a service pension. And the question is, do they receive any increase in that pension over the period of deferral? The volunteer fire plan is earning interest, presumably, on the assets that underlie that benefit. And is the volunteer firefighter to receive any portion of that investment gain or increase in value in their pension? And over the years, that has been permitted. What rate of interest on deferred service pensions has been an item that's been changed several different times. Current law permits the rate to be set by the Board of Trustees of the Volunteer Fire Plan, and law was conflicting as to whether the municipality had to only approve that process or whether the municipality had to approve each rate set each time the interest rate was changed. This clarifies the law that the municipality approves each interest rate resetting. And that's the principal substantive change. And this is the recommendation of that volunteer working group.
Representative Heffner.
Thank you.
People, audience, we're getting feedback on the microphones. So cell phones should be off. And because we're clicking, it affects the tape and affects the being able to transcribe the tape. So just a reminder to people. Any further questions of the pension bill? Mr. Martin. Representative Kahn.
I just want to, again, claim a little credit for something. When I first chaired government operations, I was the person who decided we would have an omnibus pension bill instead of 40 and 50 individual pension bills. So that was still, even if we have a little longer discussion today, that was still a good idea. So.
And there's a 16A amendment here, Representative Murphy. Do we need to put that on? It looks like a technical. Maybe Mr. Martin can describe it.
The police association one.
Members, there is a 16A amendment that we've passed on to you. It was taken up in the Senate, and that's why we sent it over to you. It does three different things, two of which you might want to do, and the third you might not want to do. First three lines of the amendment, lines 1.3 through 1.5, are strictly technical. This article cleans up Minnesota statutes to, with respect to local police and paid fire pension plans. The state back 50 years ago had 50 or more police and paid fire pension plans. Over time, they've been phased out. Over time, they've been consolidated into PERA, Police and Fire. The last of those consolidations occurred in 2012 when the Fairmont Police and the Virginia Fire Plans consolidated with PERA, Police and Fire. There's a whole body of statute law that governs these local police and paid fire plans and now is obsolete. And what this article does primarily is to get rid of those obsolete statutes and also to clean out all references to police relief associations and paid fire relief associations. The first three lines, we missed a couple of references to police relief associations, and we're correcting that. The amendment at line 1.6 and at 1.12 and 1.13 relate to the Bloomington Volunteer Fire Plan. Bloomington is an unusual for Minnesota volunteer fire plan in that it's a volunteer fire department, but it has a pension plan that resembles what the old paid fire plan pension benefit structure used to be. It bases its pension on the ongoing salary of a Bloomington police officer when a Bloomington volunteer fire member retires. It's unique in Minnesota. What we're doing in this article is proposing changing the law that used to govern the way we funded local police and paid fire plans, since it only applies now to Bloomington, to shift that out of being a general statute, make it a Bloomington-only statute. As part of that law, it had a minimum member contribution rate, and that's what's affected by this amendment. The Bloomington Volunteer Fire Plans, volunteer firefighters, since they're not paid firefighters, don't make a member contribution. And so having this member contribution provision didn't make any sense. Bloomington called me up the other day and suggested that it'd be good to get rid of it, and I concur that it doesn't really have any application under current law. There's no reason to keep that provision that did apply to the other 50 or so volunteer or local police or and paid fire plans, that it was unnecessary. The remaining portion of the amendment, lines 1 through 7 and through 1.11, have to do with attempting to fold the various consolidation laws related to Minneapolis Police, Minneapolis Fire, Virginia Fire, and Fairmont Police, and the old and the provisions that related to the other local police and paid fire consolidation accounts that merged with PERA Police and Fire in 1999, all into a single statute. We thought we got that correct. Mr. Rice and Mr. Johnson, who represent the Minneapolis Police and Minneapolis Fire, respectively, have some questions about whether we captured the entirety of that. And in the Senate, they did remove the amalgamation provisions, and that's what would be done in 1.7 through 1.11. Their recommendation is to leave it in this bill, not to do 1.7 through 1.11, so that the issue still remains to be resolved, and they've decided that they will sit down, attempt to identify any omissions in this article for the Minneapolis Police and Fire that are still needed, and will have a corrective language for the next stop. So we amalgamated all the amendments we knew of to this in one amendment. Unfortunately, it does have this third item that the folks who asked for it in the Senate are asking you not to do it here. So my recommendation would be, if you want to process this amendment, to do the amendment lines 1.3 through 1.6 and 1.12 through 1.15, and not to do 1.7 through 1.11.
Representative Murphy, is that your wish?
I'll accept Mr. With the recommendation.
Representative Druskowski.
Recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the SO 489-16A amendment with a modification to remove lines 1.7 through 1.11. As Mr. Martin articulated.
Representative Ruskowski moves the 16A amendment with the modification of deleting 1.7 to 1.11. Everybody understand the amendment? Any questions? Mr. Shepherd, you have that? All in favor of the amendment, 16A amendment as modified, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. Any further questions of the pension report? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the pension bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 629 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And did we ask for a roll call on this, or... Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The bill's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Howell, are you still here?
Yes, ma'am, but that's 20.
If not, Representative Morgan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And House File 767, and Mr. Shepherd's telling me that only portion of this, the first, is applicable to our jurisdiction. So, Section 1. And members, if you want to look at the bill quickly, if you want to, Representative Morgan, I'll move that House File 767 be recommended to pass and be referred re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain that that is the right referral.
Where do you suspect it? I see
We don't think that there's any cost in the bill, Mr. Chair. It's a policy.
Did they ask for it?
He asked for it?
They asked. I'm being told that they asked for it. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And the chair asked for it, we'll send it where the chair asked for it.
We'll do what Representative Huntley wants. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I do have an author's amendment, but before we get to that, I'd like to talk just briefly about Section 1. I believe it's the A6 amendment.
I have that in front of me. And what does your A6 amendment do?
May I get to that in just a moment,
sure.
Mr. Chair? Thank you very much. The House File 767 is a Department of Human Services policy bill in the area of continuing care. Section 1 creates an exemption in the number of task forces that a state agency can have. I would like Laura Sales from the department to talk briefly about why the exemption is needed. And then I would like to move the amendment, which is a slight change in the language represented by recommended by Mr. Shepard. So,
Ms. Sales.
Hi.
Welcome to Kumi.
My name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. What we're asking here for is an exemption to the rule for the creation of an agency to have four task force when those task force are mandated by a court order. So it's just asking that if a court orders that we create a task force, that it doesn't count against that four limit, that number of four limit on the number of task forces an agency can have.
And Mr. Chair, the current language in the bill, it was recommended by Mr. Shepard that we modify that language just a little bit to be more clear in what we're trying to do. So at this point, I would appreciate if someone would move the A6 amendment.
I'll move the A6 amendment to House File 767. And everybody have that in front of them? All in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll stand for questions on Section 1 if there are any.
Any questions of the bill or the testifier or the author? Anybody in the audience needs to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 767, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. The bill is adopted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
That goes quickly. Mr. Howell, Representative Howell. House File 655.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, House File 655, the reason it's before us is in another committee, the bill we heard the other day from Representative Bly, the Save the Farm bill, was attached to this, and that's why it came here. And I believe we have an amendment, and I'll start off by I'll move House File 655 be recommended to pass. And then there's an A2 amendment that's my understanding that takes out the Bly bill. And if we take out the Bly bill, this doesn't need to be here. We can just send it to the General Register. And so I'll move the A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. And so if you just want to quickly describe the bill and what it does and this going forward, and we'll get you out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, thanks for hearing the bill. The current bill, all it does is removes the requirement to identify a route as preferred when we're looking at routes for high-voltage transmission lines. So what this really does is because what happens currently when we're looking at the route selection for high voltage transmission lines is they identify more than one route. They have to identify two routes, and one gets identified as preferred. So the people that show up are on the preferred route. And the folks that are on an alternate route, generally speaking, don't show up at the meetings. And if that route on the preferred route, if there's enough testimony and they shift that route from the preferred route to an alternate route, it's very difficult to move that again. And that's when the people on the alternate route get all up in arms. Well, they said it wasn't going to come here. It was going to go on the preferred route. Well, that's where the problems occur. So what this does is just identify all routes as possible routes or alternate routes, and it takes out that preferred language and requires it just to identify them. So hopefully the apathy of the people on these routes, it'll create more public input and energize the folks to actually show up. That's really what the bill does.
Members, any questions of the author? Is there anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 655, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Member.
Have a good weekend. House File 1284, Representative Schoen. What's that? Representative Newton?
Yes.
Representative Newton, why don't you step up to the plate? House File 1383.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's right, Joan.
Doing two bills in the.
Joan gave you a notice. I'll move House File 1383 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Education Finance Committee. And. Representative Newton, if you describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an agency bill that was worked out with the governor's office to create a task force of at least 10 members to look into the delivery of special education and the statutes and rules around special education. As you know, about 10 days ago, I think it was, the Office of the Legislative Auditor came out with a rather scathing report on the number of laws and rules that we have from the state that exceed federal requirements for special education. And one of the things we want to look at at this committee is how many of these rules and statutes are necessary, if we can compress some of them, if we can make the system a little bit easier. So all this bill does is sets up a task force that has an expiration date of the 16th of February next year, so it's not an ongoing thing. And it'll bring in the interested parties, parents, special education teachers, school districts, NAMI, PACER, all of the organizations that have interest in special education.
Any questions of the test of the author? Anybody in the audience? Representative Pepin, did you put your hand up? Or?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Newton. Well, first, Mr. Chair, where did you send this bill to?
It's going to help Education Finance.
Education Finance.
Ed Finance. I was just wondering, are they, I don't know that it's specified in here, and I haven't had much of a chance to look at it beforehand. Is there a cost to this? Will they be getting per diem? How will it be funded? Yeah. I know it's going to finance, but it's a little sketchy here.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. I'm looking to Mr. McHenry from the department, but as I understand it, there's no per diem involved. The only cost would be transportation costs of having the people come, because it's a statewide task force. Is that correct? Yes. And so it's minor costs, because it'll be transportation if they live 50 miles or more away from the capital.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Newton. Is the kind of the purpose overall, are you trying to find ways to, I mean, obviously special education is a huge cost to districts, and we've got an unfunded, you know, ongoing federal mandate, a very expensive one, and will you, the task force be looking at recommendations to change that or to help pay for these costs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, that's, as I gather, the primary purpose of this is to look at the mandates that are state mandates that exceed the federal mandates and see what the burden is on the school districts and whether there's some way for us to eliminate some of the mandates, consolidate, streamline the delivery of special education to make it, you know, one of the problems we have with special education is our teachers are spending so much time with paperwork and meetings that they don't have the time to devote to the children. So that's what we're, our main intent is, to make sure that our special education teachers are in the classroom working with kids rather than doing paperwork and reports and attending meetings.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Newton. So, Representative, it sounds like this is going to be a one-time deal. They meet and do their job, and we could be very, very certain we won't be extending the sunset on this one, probably. Is that your sense?
Yes. Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Jaskowski, yes, that's the intent, is to have this one-time meeting, get this done, and if the task force expires in February 2014. The governor has a lot of interest in this, and if you recall his State of the State address, one of the things he addressed was eliminating unnecessary statutes, and this is a part of that.
Thank you.
Representative Jaskowski. Again, anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1383 be passed and re-referred to Education Finance Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion's approved. The bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Representative Schoen. House File 1284.
Yes, sir.
I'll move House File 1284 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Schoen, please describe your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very short, simple bill. All we're looking for is to make sure that no local jurisdictions criminalize the sale of motor fuel by not basically not allowing prepay only. And I'll keep it short and let my testifier describe what action they're looking for, and then I'll take the landing.
And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rick Dean. I'm here representing Dean Oil Company. We are a fourth-generation gasoline, heating oil, and diesel fuel distributor, and we also own and operate two convenience stores, one of which being in the city of Coon Rapids. We're here today to talk to you about the effects that the prepay ordinance has had on our business. 2012 was shaping up to be a pretty solid year for our Coon Rapids store. Inside sales were up about 6%. Gasoline sales were up 0.5%. Considering the high price of gas we experienced in 2012, we're fairly satisfied with those numbers. That changed dramatically in August of 2012 when the prepay ordinance took effect. We started feeling the financial impact immediately. Inside sales and gasoline sales started decreasing while the public adjusted and complained about the new law. Customers berated cashiers, complaining, asking why we were treating them like criminals and why we thought they were criminals. Customers who wished to use a coupon found the process extremely cumbersome. They would have to come inside the store first, guesstimate how many gallons of gas they were going to need at the pump, go back out to the pump, pump the gas, and oftentimes having to return to the store and get a refund because they overestimated their needs. These transactions typically ended with, I'm never buying another gallon of gasoline in Coon Rapids again. The situation has continued to worsen. September and October, gasoline sales continued to decline. November and since, we have seen declines in gasoline sales as much as 34%, with inside sales following the trend down as much as 10%. Considering we were up 6% prior to the ordinance taking effect, it's been very punitive for our business. I have been forced to make some dramatic changes at our store. We've cut payroll hours 32 hours per month. We've had to reduce starting wages for new employees. And now we're forced to consider raising the prices of our goods and products that we sell inside the store to try to offset the negative cash flow position that this ordinance has placed upon our small business. I feared this ordinance would have a negative impact on our small business when it first passed, but in reality it's much worse than I feared. For the calendar year of 2011, we had less than $1,000 in drive-offs. And so far through 7 months with the prepay ordinance in effect, we've lost over $20,000 in lost sales. Well, that's all I have for you today, sir. Any questions, I feel free to ask to the best of my ability.
If not, I also have an Ann Lindstrom for the League of Cities. Ms. Lindstrom, please state your name for the tape and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thanks for giving me a second just to bring another perspective to this discussion. The League of Minnesota Cities opposes this bill because it restricts local control. So from our understanding of the situation, the city of Coon Rapids faced a very high level of drive-offs. And so in 2010, there were 492. In 2011, there were 481. So it's the first city in the state to pass a law like this, and they did so through the process of public meetings and hearings and listening to residents about what the best course of action would be, and then have continued to follow up. And it's our understanding, actually, that at the city this week, they had another meeting about it, and according to the city attorney, after discussing the prepay ordinance at a work session, they are going to introduce an ordinance to repeal the prepay ordinance at its next regular meeting in April. So, but regardless of the specific situation in this, what we see, our perspective from the league, is that the city council actually did what the city council should do. There was a problem that was a burden on public safety and the police department investigating it. It was a burden for the businesses because they were losing money. And so through public input, decided to craft this ordinance, and then given it doesn't seem to be working as well, they're going to repeal it. So our concern going forward is that if there's a city that faces a situation like this in the future, this statute will now restrict them from being able to look at doing it at the local level because the statute is not here.
Any questions of the testifier? Anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1284 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. Representative Schoen, you had your finger up. You want to comment?
Just real quick, Mr. Chair and members. In my day job, drive-offs drive me nuts. They really do. But this is one of those situations where local control probably needs to be with the police department and the city council making the decision to say, no, we're not going to respond. The Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association has done a really good job putting a program together to recover the costs of drive-offs civilly that this legislature has given them the opportunity to do. And what we've really seen here is a situation where we've really put a stress on small businesses by criminalizing this opportunity, this sale fashion. And so I think if in this instance, if they want to take the chance to push the button to say, go ahead and sell the gas, and someone drives off, that's their problem. And we probably shouldn't get in the way of that opportunity for them, because it's obviously been a detriment to their businesses, and we don't want to see that happen around the state. So that's our goal.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schoen, thanks for bringing this bill. It's a very good bill, and thank you for reminding us that in this case the most local control is that of the business. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, and I'm glad I could have a moment with Representative Drazkowski. That almost felt heartfelt.
Anyway, any further questions? Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and members, I hope Representative Drazkowski's comments didn't kill the bill, so I won't comment further.
Again, I'll renew my motion that House File 1284 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is approved. Bill's passed.
Thank you, members.
Where are we at? Representative Johnson. Is that Clark or Kelvin? Representative Sawatsky. Oh, she's right there. Representative Sawatsky, House File 938. And I see an amendment here. I'll move House File 938 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. And Representative Sawatsky, do you need the A1 amendment? Is that your amendment? Or?
Yes.
And what does the A1 amendment do? Maybe Mr. Yoakum can explain that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Yoakum with the Department of Administration. What the A1 amendment does is the intent of the bill is to eliminate two reports or two products that the Department of Administration is to do, and the A1 amendment actually gets to the two underlying reports.
Does everybody understand what the Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Yoakum, I didn't understand that. Could you say that again? Be more specific as to what exactly we're talking about when we're repealing?
Repealing statute in the A1 amendment. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, the intent of the bill is to eliminate the Minnesota Milestones Report and the Guide to State Agency Requirement for Publication. And the way the bill was originally drafted, we had what was eliminated were references in other sections of statute to the bill. And so what the repealer is doing is going back to the actual the original two references for those reports and making sure that the intent of the bill is to eliminate those two reports. And that's what the repealer is eliminating, is the underlying requirement for the reports. And then what you see in the original draft of the bill are related statutes where those are also referenced.
Yeah. So, Mr. Yoakum, if I hear that right, the amendment basically fixes the bill so that it does what the bill intended to
exactly
do in the first place.
That's correct.
Representative Kahn.
I have no problems with the milestones reports, but I'm a little directories of government services and institutions, including an electronic version of the guidebook to state agency services. Sounds like kind of a useful thing for people in the state to have. Why do we want this? You know, how do I find out, for example, that there's a Department of Revenue in the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, basically, at one point, that was the only resource within state government that was collecting all those, collecting all that information. Subsequently, that has morphed over the years, and there's numerous resources for the agency to state the guide to state agencies. When we got the authority, especially the North Star authority, the old what's now Minute had been part of admin, and we had the requirement to put that information on the North Star portal. Minute now operates the North Star or the State of Minnesota portal. They have a guide to all the state agencies, about 18 pages of as a directory to each one of the state agency websites. In addition, they have the additional guides of any state agency that has Facebook, Twitter, any other social media account. That's already put out there. In addition, we do have the government white pages. The Secretary of State does publish the Blue Book that has all the functions of every state agency listed. And just to make sure, I did also check the DEX phone book, and the Blue Pages has every state agency listed. And at least with admin, we have every division listed within the phone book. So it is covered both electronically and in paper format, in multiple formats. And so, but again, the basically the transition had been made with all the agencies publishing and going through the state portal with all the information, much more expansive than what had originally been in the original guide to websites, just modernizing that, and we're trying to reflect that practice.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the explanation, Mr. Yoakum. One thing I noticed on the state website is in the last couple of years that the government white pages is more difficult to find. Is there a way you can make that more, I know it's related to the bill, but not directly, but so I appreciate all those information sources there, but just an observation is that's been rather difficult to find lately.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, that's a good point. And actually, when we introduced that bill, that concern has been brought up on occasion, and that was something that we'll be working with Minute. I think there's two components. One is making sure how easy it is to find, and then to make sure that we're working on an enterprise basis with all the HR departments to make sure that the information is put in those white pages immediately and completely, so you do have the email addresses and the phone numbers. Again, as I said, that has been brought to our attention when we introduced the bill, and that has started a pretty good conversation at the enterprise level.
Representative Drazkowski. Any further questions? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is really on behalf of seniors who don't access the Internet, and wondering how large this publication that is going to go away, the agency organization guidebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody, that's my first question. I have
okay.
a few follow-up.
Mr. Yoakum.
It's a... Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, that hasn't been published for several years. That was I think the document itself was about 300 to 400 pages. And what was interesting is at the time, especially when they were doing the conversion to put that onto electronically, the legislature authorized the MAD, or the Management Analysis Development, to do a study on the usefulness of the guidebook itself and how much it would be used being online. And basically their conclusion at the report was, as soon as that agency guide was and that phone book was published, it was readily ignored by the public for the fact it was considered to be out of date the moment it was actually published and consequently put online. And that's why we've transitioned to the websites and the white pages, because those are supposed to be continually updated. But in addition, but directly in response to your question, the Secretary of State's Blue Book, I believe, is published, I think, biannually. And then, obviously, all the divisions generally are listed, and at least when I was checking the phone book to make sure that's updated in the phone book regularly also. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And actually, I have no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, we have to do the amendment. Yes, I'll move the A1 amendment that we've been discussing. All in favor of the 938 A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. Now I'll renew my motion that House File 938, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The bill's passed.
Mr. Chair, can I say hi? At least I'm on the record for saying this is the easiest bill we've had. Thank you.
Representative Sawaski, you were there for the ride. We're moving along here. House File 855. I see Mr. Representative Johnson's in the room now. And I'll move House File 855 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. And I see no amendments. So, Representative Johnson, please explain your bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the purpose of this bill is to change language related to how the Department of Administration handles recycling in the Capitol complex and other buildings under the department's custodial control in order to better reflect current practice. And I would also like to note that if you look at the language, there's more language eliminated in this proposal than is added, and I'm proud of that little fact. I will now introduce Kurt Yoakum, who you know is from the Department of Administration Commissioner's Office, to explain the provisions of the bill.
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Yoakum. Please again state your name for the tape.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Yoakum with the Minnesota Department of Administration. Again, this is a cleanup bill to modernize or have a current statute reflect the current operations of Department of Administration and Recycling. Changes were made several years ago that the recycling services at the Department of Administration were no longer a general fund duty, but an internal service fund, and meaning being charged. We would charge agencies for how we do the service. The service is now provided through a rehabilitative services for intellectually disabled adults. That's a certified deed service. In any event, what we're modernizing with statute is getting the statute to reflect that the Department of Administration has custodial control over about 22 state buildings, and primarily within the Capitol complex, and then there's a few outside the Capitol complex where we provide the custodial services. And so it's making sure that we're responsible for the recycling services in there, still setting the policies for that, but also doing all the reporting for those. But we're not doing it on a statewide basis for the different for other, whether it's leased buildings or state buildings throughout the state. Those agencies working with the municipality and counties would still continue to report that data to the Pollution Control Agency, and we would handle it for the Capitol Complex where we actually do serve those. And then ultimately, the other language in there is reflecting basically a maturing of the recycling industry. It requires that the state, the original statute required that the state have a recycling facility where the materials were actually sorted and done that. Since we have a service that is doing the recycling, there's no longer a need for the state to have that recycling facility, and basically that was done at 321 Grove Street where we have our trade shop down there, and that's now done off-site. And basically the reason why we had that requirement initially was that when the state got into recycling, we were ahead of the market, ahead of the curve, and we were basically having to provide all the services ourselves. Why there wasn't a mature market for that. That subsequently changed over the years.
Representative Johnson, is your phone off? It seems like when you came to the buzzing started when the...
He doesn't want any record of this bill.
I don't know, looking at the fact that it's removing more language from the than putting into the statute, Representative Biskins always talked about that, making the book smaller. I think he would be proud of this bill also.
Mr. Chairman, if I just may add, the overall view, again, this does not change that the Department of Administration still has to oversee recycling within the Capitol complex. We're not changing that. We still will be achieving or striving towards the goals that are set, and the services definitely will still be provided. We're not changing any of that. It's just how the services are delivered.
Representative Dill, did you have any questions?
No, I looked it over, and I'm fine with it not going to the policy committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dill. Any further questions of the members of the committee? Anybody else in the... Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, so I think I like your bill. So what you're realizing, or what we're realizing, or Mr. Yoakum, is that maybe when this the MPCA and their advice to a past legislature and was requiring more detail on their control of this area than was absolutely necessary, and we're realizing that maybe we overstepped at one point in our past. Is that what we're seeing? Is that an observation?
Mr. Yoakum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Druskowski, I don't think that's what we're seeing here, for the fact that we still work quite closely with Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and that we still we'll still have the requirement to report to those report to them, and we're giving them those details. So I guess I don't see our relationship with the Pollution Control Agency changing. So to answer your question.
Thank you.
Mr. Yoakum, I think you said it earlier, it's the maturing of the market. Yeah. I know the city of Minneapolis has gone to single source collection where they used to have separate, and I think that's what you're saying you're doing here, is just the way the market's changing. Instead of us having to separate it, the companies doing it.
I think one example of that is if you're over at the MnDOT cafeteria where you used to have all the recycling bins in the cafeteria, that's now you're sending it right through the conveyor belt, and that's being sorted off-site, and we're actually getting higher collection rates through that, and those are the types of changes that you're seeing as we modernize this.
So with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 855 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The bills have passed. Moving along here real well. Representative Winkler. House File 1220, and I believe this I've got down here has got to go to Education Finance.
Very well, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1220 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the committee on K-12 Finance. I do have a numerical amendment, an oral numerical amendment.
Mr. Shepherd, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.9, in place of the number 4, I would put the number 5. So we go to 15 members, which if you add up the organizations and groups that are supposed to be represented in that list in the new language, it actually adds up to 15.
So I believe the proper motion would be to change 14, or you're modifying your bill from 14 to 15.
I think it's an amendment, Mr. Chair, because it can't incorporate it.
All in favor of the, everybody understand the amendment going from 14 to 15. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, is there, since you're adding another member, are you and the rest of the membership is laid out, is there any change needed there? Or what would the additional member be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, if you actually add up the numbers, lines 1.17 has rural, urban, and suburban school districts, and to get all one from each, you'd have to get to 15.
Any further questions? All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. And your bill, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, I think in education world, the concept of online learning has expanded to include a lot of questions about the best way to incorporate technology into the classroom. So we're no longer talking about just distance learning, but all the ways that technology and digital learning is incorporated into classroom discussion. So the idea here is that we would expand the scope of this online learning advisory council to include all digital learning. There is a sunset of 2013. This extends it out for 3 years, so it's still sunsetted. And the discussion of the education committee was quite positive about the need to better study, incorporate, and really just expand best practices for incorporating technology into education. That's what this bill is about.
Any questions of the author? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 1220 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion's approved. The motion's adopted. The bill's passed. And finally, Representative Hanstead, I'm going to step in for Representative Freiberg, who is, I believe, under the weather and not here today. Representative Hanson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move House File 866.
Needs to go to Ways and Means.
Pass and go to Ways and Means. And there are a couple of author's amendments.
Which do you want to take first? The A2?
A2, I'd move A2 to get as an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, this isn't the amendment. It's to the motion to move it to Ways and Means. Section 1 deals with data privacy, and I don't believe it's been to civil law yet, so I think that it needs to go to civil law committee because it makes data public at the time the date specified in the solicitation. So it makes more information available to the public, and it deals with data privacy.
We have a We have some testifiers here who could.
We'll go to the testifiers, and we can modify the amendment if we need to.
Mr.
Pepin, is that okay?
Mr.
Chairman,
Mr.
Yoakum. Representative Pepin again, Kurt Yoakum with the Department of Administration. Mr. Allen will actually testify to the bill, but there was a misdrafting of the bill. Current law, what you see in the amendment on lines, I think 1-2 through 1-4, would basically clarify we're keeping all the data that's currently public. Making sure that that stays public. There was two words that were inadvertently dropped in the drafting of the bill, so we're ensuring that current law stays the same as to what was public before, and a bid opening will still remain public. I checked with civil law and made sure, since we were having this amendment on there, since current law wasn't being changed, they did not want to see that.
So, Mr. Yoakum, does this substantially change Data Practices Act?
No, Mr. Chairman, what the amendment is doing is making sure that we are consistent with current law, and so that there is no change to data practices.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Yoakum. You said that it doesn't change what remains what's public is still public, but what about what's private? Is what's private still private?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, correct. We won't be changing anything that's public or private, making no changes for public or private data.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin. So the A2 amendment, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Then motion is approved. The amendment's adopted.
And Mr. Chair, I'd move the A3 amendment. And again, the first A2 amendment that was standards, this one deals with projects.
And members, the A3 amendment, yesterday in State Gov Finance, the governor's recommendations for the omnibus bill came forward, and this was noticed that they're creating a new council, and we noticed that, and that's why this amendment's here, is to put this on so that we can hear this language, because it wasn't brought to us before that. So that's why we're putting this amendment on the bill. So members, that's what we're here about. That's what this is here about. So, Representative Hansen.
I'd encourage adoption of the A3 amendment.
And I see Mr. Please identify yourself with the tape and explain what this commission, or this council is going to do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is John Eichten. I'm the legislative liaison for the Office of Enterprise Technology. The e-government advisory council established between lines 2.9 and 2.32 will provide oversight of the convenience fee receipts that are brought in under a new public-private partnership between Minute and a vendor that would be selected through an RFP process. The intent is to build out additional e-government services, and the council would provide oversight over funds that are brought in through an online transaction convenience fee. This is a model that 26 other states have used to grow the suite of available e-government services. And Minute, we feel we can, through this partnership, we can leverage existing e-government applications, and the need for the council is modeled after other states who've adopted this funding model, and provides additional oversight, reports back to relevant committees as to what services are being developed and what fees are being placed on those online services. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kahn.
Since we're changing the name of OET to Minute Services, shouldn't we change it in this?
Mr.
Or will it automatically happen when the other bill passes?
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the other bill does contain revisers' instructions to change all instances of Office of Enterprise Technology to Office of Minute Services.
Any further questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, what was your name?
Eichten.
Eichten, Mr. Eichten. So I'm just trying to understand this. This is the first time I've seen the amendment. So this is a lot. This is going to be managed by a third-party vendor. Is that?
In partnership with Eichten. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members, in partnership with Minute. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Eichten. Will the third party be able to sell this information?
No,
Mr. Eichten.
what controls are in place?
No, the third party would act as the agent of Minute and the other agencies who may have authority to provide certain services, perform certain transactions, but the vendor would not have authority to sell any additional data, and agencies nor Minute would be we are not being provided any additional authority to sell data than what is currently in law.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Eichten, so is there what's the fee?
The fee
Mr. Eichten.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members, the fee is a transaction fee anywhere between $0 and $2. The amount for a particular service that's developed would be recommended by the council, be approved by the council, and placed on that particular service. Largely, high-volume business services would those funds would be leveraged in order to support development of free online services for citizens. And the fee for a particular service could be set anywhere from $0 to $2 under this proposal.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Eichten. So who gets the fee, the state or the third-party vendor?
It's held in partner. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it is held in partnership between the vendor and the state, or Minute would hold the funds. Either are allowed within the language.
Representative Pepin.
Okay. How, so you're convinced that there won't be data privacy concerns with the third party being involved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, 26 states use this model, and there are some leading national vendors who work through this partnership arrangement. We feel confident that we would write into any contract appropriate security data controls that would ensure that no data would be accessed inappropriately or sold inappropriately.
Representative Kaplan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Eichten. What exactly, what type of information, what are we talking about here?
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, you know, I can point to two examples in other states. The state of South Carolina recently won the Digital Government Achievement Award for their Uniform Commercial Code lookup service. It allowed businesses and citizens to file, search, and retrieve Uniform Commercial Code documents electronically. The state of Utah built the State Construction Registry, provided users a standardized statewide system for filing and managing preliminary notices, notices of commencement and completion. Idaho built the Idaho Trucking Portal, which is a partnership between their departments of transportation, their tax commission, their state police, simplified the interaction between commercial drivers and related businesses in the state of Idaho. That, to give you some idea of how this might work, the private partner would perform some outreach, would go to business groups, would go to particular industries, such as perhaps a large trucking operator, and say, what kind of information do you wish you were able to get from the state for your business, or what transactions do you wish you were able to engage in online more efficiently? Where they deem appropriate demand to be there, we would initiate some study of a potential new online service. A fee within the range allowed by law would be set. The new service would be developed by the vendor. They would provide the costs of initial development, and then that would be recouped through transaction fee. So it allows us to put new services online more quickly without going through traditional RFP processes for each additional service, and bring these services to market more quickly.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you.
So,
better efficiency in government.
Absolutely, that's the idea, and based on some academic studies that have been done, this is helping to move services online, increase in efficiency, and just general level of service that citizens can enjoy.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Eichten. You know, I'm concerned, of course, that I like the fact that we're expanding the availability of services, but we're also charging the public more for those services, which they've already paid for within those individual agencies. I'd like to learn more about what we're going to charge people to access their government online with this. So what about the existing charges that they have? Are there existing charges that many of the agencies provide for their services, and they may have a different structure of those charges, whether they're currently offered online or maybe not offered online, but prospectively would be. Tell us how that will work in relation to this new $2 fee that will be paid.
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, any service, online service that would be developed, the $2 fee would be in addition to any other statutory fees that agencies may be allowed to charge. However, we would not put a transaction fee on an existing online service because that's already been built, and there are some great examples of online services in the state of Minnesota that are currently in place. So where we would look to attach the fee is on a new service that the vendor partner would develop for the state. And so we, for something like the DNR campsite reservation site, we would not be adding an additional fee for citizens. In fact, in most states, in the 26 states that have this model, the vast majority of services for citizens online are free when they're developed by the vendor.
Representative Stowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Eichten, is the success of this approach contingent upon having an online fee paid by these businesses, or could it be as equally successful if the agencies use their existing dollars in order to fund the council and the ongoing development?
Mr. Eichten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the fee is what provides the flexibility in developing new services. If there is a demand for it from a business, but funding may not be available within the agency because of budget constraints, having this transaction fee allows us, along with the vendor, to recognize that demand, build out the service quickly, use existing applications in other states that we can customize fairly easily for the state of Minnesota, and bring that to market, charge the fee, recover the cost that we need to recover for the development over time. So it flips the usual chain of events and allows us greater flexibility and agility in meeting the needs of businesses and citizens. So I would say that's the difference, Mr. Chair.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Eichten, you mentioned budget constraints within the department. I think we're going to grow. I think the taxpayers are going to be asked to shell out $2.4 billion in the next biennium additional. So I wonder about, I always wonder about the activities of our state agencies. But if indeed the state agencies had the wherewithal to truly prioritize this and put it at the top of their priority list, where I think many would argue that it probably should be, and I might join that. And they had the capacity to make the dollars available for this. Would it work as well as charging people, or is the success completely contingent upon the people of Minnesota being charged in their online transaction?
Mr. Chair, Eichten. Representative Drazkowski, the success is contingent upon how well the service is developed and not how the funds are brought in or identified for the project overall.
Thank you.
Any further questions? So I'll move the A3 amendment, the House File 866. All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. And now to the bill, the 866, House File 866. Any further questions of the bill? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I know that you're the pinch hitter here. We've got an expert there. That's good. So on Section 2, it adds additional criteria to be a resident vendor. I see there's a couple new things, and I'm just wondering how much additional cost that will add.
Please identify yourself for the tape. And
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kent Allen. I'm with the Department of Administration. Section 2 is actually intended to ensure that resident vendors, as defined in the state procurement law, actually operate in the state of Minnesota. We have assumed that that was the intent of the legislature's efforts when it gave certain preferences to resident vendors. But in recent years, we've actually had vendors from out of state arguing that they qualify under the existing language. So what we're doing here is adding language that would ensure that to get the benefit of being a resident vendor, you actually have to have paid taxes in Minnesota and have a business address in the state of Minnesota. From a operational implementation perspective, we don't. It's not going to be more work for us, and it actually might be less work because we won't be arguing with out-of-state vendors about their qualifications.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you on that question. I'd like to move to Section 4. And it looks like there are a reporting section is taken out, and I'd just like to ask why. What's the point of that?
Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. Section 4 is eliminating some hard copy reports that we've been doing for a number of years in the area of professional technical contracts. And the intent of the provision is actually to not eliminate those reports until the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget has certified that the same data is now available online through the SWIFT system. So it's a streamlining effort as opposed to any elimination of access to information.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Allen. But so right now, the legislature would get a hard copy of the report. Is that correct?
Mr. Allen. Chair, Representative, yes, it is. And you would continue to until there's certification that there's an alternative source available for that information.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen. So at some point, your goal is then to, what this would do then, would take away the paper copy, and then so if I wanted to look it up, I would have to go on the statewide accounting and procurement system and kind of figure it out on my own. Is that correct?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the intent would be for the statewide accounting and procurement system to have a user-friendly citizen portal. And until that really is fully operational, we wouldn't be taking anything away that people are using as a as an alternative.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen. Well, what would the format, you say user-friendly, but we're voting on this. I'm voting on something that's going to take away my ability to have a nice handy copy of anything I want to review, and instead I'm going to have to go to a user-friendly, take your word that it's a user-friendly portal, and I'm not really sure what the format is going to look like, and I'm not sure I'm very comfortable with that, and I'm just trying to get a sense of why this is needed. I mean, it doesn't seem like getting a few copies, hard copies, to legislators would be, is all that difficult, and we do make that requirement quite often, and I think it's very helpful for us to get those hard copies as opposed to trying to go, you know, navigate the system.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if members really believe the hard copy is essential to their ability to get the data they need, we can continue to provide it. We put a fair amount of staff effort into compiling these reports for the hard copy version every year, and we'd prefer to devote that to other efforts, but we're not trying to deprive anyone of the information that you need to do your work either.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, I guess I think it's important that we have that info because I don't know about other members, but the time for me to go and kind of do my own research on this is somewhat limited, and sometimes when you get the hard copies that you're able to, you know, think of questions or see what's going on. I think that by putting that in, that section in, we really eliminate some transparency. And, you know, unfortunately, Representative Freiberg isn't here to ask if he would be amenable to taking that section out or that reporting requirement out. So I hate to ask Representative Hansen since he's not the chief author of this, but perhaps that would be something I would talk to him about and suggest removing on the floor. I don't think that's a good idea at all. But
Representative Pepin, this is an agency bill, so I mean, I don't think it's Representative Freiberg's reelection bill. So if we're the committee, and if we decide if that's what you want to do, take that section out. We can take that section out, and if it definitely needs to be in there, it can be added back in ways and means or on the floor or whatever. But Representative Pepin, we're the committee. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I do have some other comments on other sections, but I guess I would kind of you know, maybe I'm all alone. I guess I'd look to some other members to see if they'd be interested in doing that. I don't want to go through the efforts if I'm just going to be shot down anyway.
Representative Gill.
Thank you. I could support that. We sell trees in my district. And
it's job, job. Make it a job.
Job spell.
Representative Pugh.
Yes, I just wanted to agree that I would be very much like, I'm reliant upon documents to take notes on and to reference. So I agree with Representative Pepin.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and members, we can make this work with or without the paper copy. As I said, it would save us a considerable amount of effort if we didn't have to produce it, but we want you to have the information you need to do your jobs.
What's your pleasure, Representative Pepin?
Well, thank you. I was kind of hoping more members would chime in, but I guess then I will ask Mr. Shepherd to go ahead and tell me what the motion would be to remove that deletion of the reporting requirement. In other words, I'd like to keep it as is.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe the simplest motion would be just to delete Section 4 from the bill, and then the law would remain as it is today.
Representative Pepin moves that delete Section 4 of House File 866. Does everybody understand that? All in favor of Representative Hansen?
As acting author, I would support the amendment.
As acting author supports the amendment. All in favor of Representative Pepin's amendment to remove Section 4 from the bill, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one more question in another section.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Allen, and I'll just go straight to you since I won't put Representative Hansen on the spot. Section 7 and 8, I'm just looking at it briefly here, and it looks like it's removing the requirement that these bids be put out on the state in the state register. And I'm kind of wondering if you could talk about why. I'm worried about transparency, and I'm wondering why we wouldn't do that and how folks would know that that requirement was removed. I presume a lot of people would look to the state register to find out if there were any RFPs out there, and just wondering why we would want to remove that and how we would alert anyone interested of the change that we're making.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. The requirement to publish solicitations in the state register has been removed for almost all public notices of procurement bids and RFPs. In two specific areas, it wasn't removed from the statute in the past, and so it still remains a requirement with respect to particular types of solicitations. The state register really isn't the primary source that people rely on for this information. And the state websites are what most vendors go to and as their source of information. So this really just makes the process more consistent across different types of public purchasing. And it actually has the support of the people who publish the state register.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, so you're confident that anyone interested would already know where exactly to go to find the information they're looking for?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I'm confident that the right people will get the information they need.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on that, Mr. Allen, sorry. The agency's website would be the primary manner that, I mean, it's the replacement language says a manner designated by the commissioner. So obviously the website, you mentioned that. Are there other manners, too, that would naturally be used?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair and members, there are instances where to be more proactive in seeking vendor responses, agencies might choose to publish in local newspapers or target particular trade journals. There are services that actually look at all public solicitations across government and consolidate them as an easier reference point for vendors that don't want to check 50 different state websites. So there are a number of methods through which interested vendors obtain the information they need.
Thank you.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, could you speak just a little bit on Section 5? We add new language that says valued in excess of $5,000. It doesn't look like commissioners looking at anything valued less than $5,000. Looking for an explanation of why that is, and also in Section 6, we're upping the amount from $2,500 to $5,000. Just looking for an explanation on that.
Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, in Section 5, the current law would require agencies to do paperwork for every service procurement below $5,000. So for every oil change, car wash, very simple, low-value services, without a dollar threshold in there, there's a paperwork requirement for every one of those activities. And it's we view it as extremely time-consuming for agencies and not adding value. In the world of professional technical contracts, the statute doesn't require that certification below $5,000. So this would make that consistent with what we're doing with other sorts of contracts, and we think it would just eliminate a very high volume of non-value-added work in state agencies. With respect to Section 6, what this is really doing is indicating that the competitive bidding process would start at $5,000 rather than at $2,500. This is one of those things that probably should be adjusted periodically based on inflation and changing times, and this particular number hasn't been adjusted since 1998. And we thought 5,000 would be more consistent with some of the other things, such as the certification level that we were just talking about.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Allen. So just to clarify, back in Section 5, is there still some sort of paper trail or verification for those items valued in less than $5,000? And I understand the effort to streamline, but are we still keeping track? I mean, those items add up, and it's our job in the legislature to make sure that state agencies are being held accountable for every dollar that they spend, not just on items that are over $5,000.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, the certification really is focused primarily on the issue of whether the work could be done by state employees versus the private sector. And for the certification below $5,000, what the agency is certifying to us is that they've assessed the capacity for state employees to do the work and have found that there aren't state employees able and available to do the work. And there's obviously an interest in using state employees when they're available. But in instances of these very low dollar value procurements, it's an immense amount of paperwork to conclude that there's not a state employee that can do your car wash or your oil change.
Representative Sanders. Any further questions of the bill? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 866 as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion's adopted. The bill is passed. Members, that's our last bill for today. As you'll see, the next meeting will be at the call of the chair, where there's a couple things that may be coming to us that we may need to take care of. One that I'm aware of, having to deal with redistricting of the Met Council. We'll probably be having a meeting on that and that only. And then there may be other meetings. There may be some informational meetings that we have. So, Representative Pepin, you look like you had your hand up. Or
no.
So, anyway, so with that, if there aren't any other questions, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned the redistricting of the Met Council. Does that also affect the Metropolitan Airports Commission lines as well?
Representative Hansen, yes. For those that aren't aware, the Met Council gets redistricted. The MAC is based off the Met Council redistricting. So is the TAB board and the opens Hearts and Opens. I'm not getting the name right, but there's three other ones that are tabbed off. That happens there, but so you basically the Met Council gets redistricted. We've been getting maps and getting information. We've been working with the Senate on this, and actually have a meeting this afternoon on this with the senator who's dealing with it. And when we come up with that, we'll have a bill brought forward to deal with that and have some maps to look at and some information. So,
what did you say? What do you have an idea when that will be?
Sooner probably rather than later. It may not be the first week after we get back from break, but it'll be in April. We'll get it done quickly as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your hard work on the committee and staff as well.
Yeah. Well, and thanks for reminding me. Thank you everybody here for all their hard work and diligence and the staff and the pages. We've got a lot of bills. We've done a lot of work here. With the rule changes that we did, we kind of have borne the brunt of a lot of bills here that in the past have normally come through here. So I want to thank you all for doing a good job. So with that, we're adjourned.